Welcome to today's episode of Fire in the Belly. This is where we get to hear some pretty inspiring stories from some amazing people. You know, it's always an absolute pleasure to sit down, take time out, and have a warts and all conversation about their journey. I'm always intrigued by what it's taken for people to get to where they are today. And hopefully, in this interview, we get to hear some more about that. From this, my mission is to help people to find their own fire in their belly, and from that, to live the mightiest version of you. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy today's guest. Success is a process, not an event.
Good morning, and welcome to Fire in the Belly. Today we have myself, Mighty Pete, and we're joined by Lorna Dooley. Good morning.
Hi, Pete. Good morning. How are you?
Doing absolutely mighty well. Thank you for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on here. So, Lorna, tell us, who are you, what are you doing, where are you from?
I am from Wicklow originally. I live in Roscommon for almost the last 20 years, and I am a holistic reflexologist and massage therapist.
Okay, break that down for us a bit. Holistic reflexologist, what is a holistic reflexologist?
So reflexology is quite an ancient therapy, which involves a very in-depth, I suppose you'd call a massage of your feet. And the thinking behind it is that the nerve endings in the body end in the feet, and there are also zones in the feet. So in the 1800s, an ear, nose and throat specialist discovered, when there was very little anaesthetic, that if you press certain points in people's feet, he could actually perform minor procedures. So it was developed from there. I suppose it would be based on the similar principles to acupuncture. It's just that all the points are in the feet. And then holistic means I work just with women, and I work in a holistic sense, which means when you come to me, I get to know you in a full kind of sense of, during a consultation and in a course of treatments, figuring out your mental, physical, emotional, and often spiritual needs. So it's not just a physical experience. It can bring up deep emotions for people. I can draw on my experiences in the past in my own life and in previous trainings on maybe there are patterns in their lives or belief systems that they're operating from, and that these just need to be questioned and looked at to see if they're another way. So that's a little bit about how I work, and I also do massage in a similar way.
Well, that's awesome. So, I mean, do you have any idea why all those sort of points are in our feet then? Is there any explanation?
Well, the physiological makeup of our central nervous system means that the nerves pass through the feet at some point, and also, so there are zones in the reflexes. So it was developed further. So after Dr. William Fitzgerald discovered what he discovered, there's zones in the feet. So each of the five zones in your feet are your hands. So your big toe or your thumb is zone one. And that zone basically travels all the way from your big toe, right up your foot, into your body, up through your head, and back out to your thumb again. So if you have an imbalance or blockage or stagnation energetically in any of those zones, it can affect all the organs in that zone. So by working the feet, you can help. And it's a very unobtrusive, it's a very, very accessible way to treat people holistically. It's suitable for everybody, from babies right up to the very elderly. And it means that you can help people to, you know, perhaps just let go of something that they're carrying. Now, I can't diagnose people and I can't cure them, but your body is always looking to come back to balance. It's always working for you to come back to homeostasis. And I help your body to work with you. And then in a whole sense, looking at a package for, you know, maybe you're not drinking enough water. Maybe you're stuck in your mind with some kind of a belief that you're carrying, and we can tease that out. So, that's a little bit more about how it works.
There's two things you've talked about there. One is, you know, you talked about energetically. So, I mean, if you give us that, and then maybe if you can give us an idea in terms of what symptoms or, you know, what typically people may come to you with that would sort of be, you know, that you're able to sort of work with.
So energetically, how I work with people is I'm trained in energy management. So you're talking about the chakras in the body. So there are seven of them, and they're kind of energy centers. And a lot of the time, they're also where bundles of nerves are. So typically, you might find somebody who's got a lot of headaches and their third eye, their inner wisdom maybe is blocked, and they're just not allowing themselves to see something that they need to see. I also work then, in a sense, when I'm working through the feet. So I might come across a spot or a reflex on the foot, and it'll be sore, you know, it'll be tender, and your client might kind of on the bed, like, that's a little bit tender. So the organs in the body are also connected to emotions, and that's quite an old therapeutic way of working as well. So, for example, the kidneys carry fear, the lungs carry grief, the you know, the bladder can sometimes mean that you're a bit peed off about life or with somebody. So that's the energetic side of it. And typically, as I say, I just work with women, and that was a conscious choice that I made. But reflexology is extremely powerful for hormonal and reproductive issues. It is also, you know, very, very useful, say, if people have digestive problems, constipation, or, you know, people will come in, stress and anxiety. And at the moment, and since I reopened after lockdown, people who never experienced stress or who felt they had very robust mental health are really being challenged, and they're holding their breath. Like, a lot of people are just coming in, and they literally, it's 1 hour in the week where they just get to come in, switch off. I encourage them not to talk. You know, I do a bit of relaxation and meditation at the start of a treatment. So a little bit of focusing on their breathing, and the amount of people who are just shallow breathing, like they're literally not taking a breath into their belly or their diaphragm. It's just stopping here, and they're holding their breath. So for that alone, because stress is an undercurrent and a factor in so many chronic illnesses. I'm also trained in oncology and palliative care reflexology. So there's a whole different way of working if somebody's on chemotherapy or towards the end of their life. You know, you work much gentler. But really, reflexology as a therapeutic treatment is, you know, and how I came to it was I experienced it during pregnancy. And just the sense of relaxation. And that pregnancy was really quite a different experience because of a tendon for reflexology.
Oh, wow. That's quite a story. There's a lot going on there. So before we really get into it, first of all, I'd ask is, what does fire in the belly mean to you?
Fire in the belly to me is being authentic. There is only one version of me now. That wasn't always the case. And I try to live on a daily basis by a set of spiritual principles that mean I'm living authentically, and that when I put my head on the pillow at night, I'm pretty much sure that during my day, I've lived as well as I can for that day. And what carries me constantly is to try and bring this message to people that there is another way to live, you know, that you can question belief systems, and that you can create your own thoughts, that you don't have to do what you do because you always did it, or because your ancestors did it, or your family did it, or people around you are doing it, and that you can choose your own path in life and, you know, be true to it.
And is that what you're passionate about? Is that your thing?
Absolutely. And I suppose, you know, over the last 10, maybe 15 years, 10 to 13 years, I've had people say to me so often, you need to write a book. You should be telling people this story. You know, when I talk to people one-to-one, and I've always had this drive that I needed women to hear what I had heard, what's been told to me, and what I've learned. Through pain a lot of the time, and through, you know, without pain there isn't growth. But I felt a little bit, I suppose, restricted or unsure as to how I would carry that message. So in the last 2 years, I've retrained in all my therapies and become qualified took on new courses. And it's in a small way, but for me, every woman who comes through my doors and hears, you know, you can take care of yourself. You can put yourself first. Self-care is vital. This is the only thing you have to do in a day is take care of yourself. And most women are like, what? You know, it couldn't be that simple. And that's exactly what I thought. But if we don't take care of ourselves, we're not in a position to take care of anybody else. And traditionally, we've been nurtured and raised to be caregivers in society, you know, as females. And we're also the smoother overs, and we're the, you know, don't cause any problems. And I believe that there's always a way to question, and there's always a way to bring change, and it can be gentle. It doesn't always have to be confrontational or angry or aggressive, but that it's really vital, that it's really, really vital. And I'm passionate that women hear that you don't have to be a certain way to have self-love. You don't have to look a certain way. You don't have to weigh a certain weight or a number on a dress. You don't need, you know, a substance to prop you up. You don't need the approval of another human being to say that you're okay and you deserve to take up the space that you take up. So yeah, that's my passion. My passion is for women to hear that you can make changes. It is possible.
When you mentioned authenticity there, I was getting a lot of sort of energy. There's a lot of emotion attached to that, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah, I mean, I always think I've lived a life that's, you know, been full of paradox. So growing up, I would have always appeared to people to be very confident and self-assured. You know, I would have had it said to me, oh, you can mix with everybody and you can talk to everybody. And it was kind of a badge of honor, really, to be honest. You know, it was something that I wore with pride and believed was very valuable. And it took until my early 30s to realize that I actually didn't really know who I was at all. So I was a kind of a mishmash put together chameleon, you know, and I would be whoever you needed me to be. So that meant that I really didn't own my own thoughts. You know, and I remember somebody saying that to me when I was in my early 30s, that they didn't know who they were. And I remember thinking, don't be so ridiculous. How could you get to this age and not know who you are? I knew what I did. I knew I was a mother. I knew I was a wife. You know, I knew the business I was involved in at that time. But what I didn't realize was that, you know, I spent a lot of my life running. And really what I was running from was my true self, my own deep inner self, my essence that's been there, you know, from the time that the idea of me was created and I got separated from it, you know, and separated from it at a very young age and into that crack or into that crevice or whatever you want to call it, I started to need to put stuff into it. So for me, originally, it would have been food, you know, to soothe and comfort. And then it progressed to needing alcohol or cigarettes or people, you know, relationships. It could have been shopping. Dieting became a huge, huge problem for me for 25 years. All to avoid standing still and feeling the original traumas. And realizing that, you know, they didn't kill me when they happened. They're not going to kill me now by feeling them. So, yeah, I didn't live an authentic life, but I survived, you know, and I stayed alive because I ran from things that I wasn't able to cope with for a long time.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Take us back. I mean, you talked about when you separated from sort of who you truly are when you were young. I mean, take us back first of all and paint a picture of who Lorna was as a mini Lorna when life was good and all was going on.
Yeah. So I'm the youngest of four and I grew up in Wicklow. Two older brothers and an older sister. And I don't have really, really early memories, you know, but from photographs and from stories and from a sense of who I was, you know, and I keep little photographs of mini me at different ages because I believe it's really important to honor those inner children. I loved to be outside. I loved to be I loved to be in nature. I was happy, go lucky, on the outside a lot of the time. I was a little entertainer. I was frequently rolled out to sing, and or I'd sing and make them stand outside the door because I was shy, you know, and because I'm talkative. For a long, long time, I believed I was an extrovert, but I'm actually not. I'm not shy, but I'm introverted. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite comfortable in my own company, and I like to be around people that I'm comfortable with. But I can struggle now in situations where, again, it comes back to authenticity. If I feel I can't really be my true self, I can sometimes pay a price for that. So I have to be careful sometimes where I put myself, and I have to spiritually protect myself if I'm going into situations where I know, which we have to in life. I mean, sometimes we have to put on a little bit of a mask, but a mask can be dangerous for me. You know, I have to consciously decide, you know, I need to protect myself in this situation for a little while, and I need to leave when I know that I could pay a price for it afterwards.
For anyone listening, I mean, how do you recognize that in yourself? I mean, a situation that maybe isn't good for you or it's not serving you, what would that feel like or look like?
Well, I could have, I'll talk a lot. You know, I could find myself maybe sharing stuff, you know, somebody could ask me a question, and it's about boundaries. You know, it's about boundaries. And when, you know, when I go out in life on a daily basis, it's important for me to be grounded before I leave my home, to be grounded before I go to work, to be connected spiritually. It's a process that I engage in as soon as I wake in the mornings, because my head will take off before I've put my feet on the ground. You know, I could have the whole world worries on my shoulders before I'll have made it as far as my ensuite bathroom. So when I wake in the mornings, I ground myself and I connect spiritually to a power outside of me. And that means that I don't take on other people's stuff. You know, it allows me to do the work that I do, because while it's a deep connection often that I'm making with women, we're two separate entities. Whereas for a long, long time, I didn't know where I started and you ended, you know, and I didn't know how to not take on your problems. I didn't know how to not be the fixer. So this is a very long-winded way of answering your question. But if I'm in a situation where I'm energetically aware that boundaries are not in place, you know, so there could be a bit of, for example, if I go out and I, you know, I don't drink anymore, but I have no issue with people who drink, provided I'm feeling grounded and well in myself. But if I get a sense of, you know, this is getting a little bit messy, or this is, and trust me, I would have been in the thick of it in my heyday and the cause of most of the messiness. But if I have a sense that this is a little bit, you know, it's not okay for me, I'm going to pay a price for this. I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning feeling a bit sluggish, a bit, you know, emotionally drained, then I just get my out. Or if I can't get an out, I just increase my spiritual shield, I suppose, if you want to call it, for want of a better word.
And that's quite something, I suppose. And what, because you mentioned there in your childhood, and even when you were sort of, you know, the tone of the context changed when you were sort of saying you were sort of wheeled out to perform, you know, what was the changeover for you there? I mean, for simplicity of calling it, is that a pleaser gene? Is that just, you know, sort of who you were sort of wanting to be, or to seeking that sort of feedback? Do you know what it was?
Yeah, I think I just was a natural born people pleaser, you know, and I've done years of therapy and I've analyzed it to death, and that doesn't really, you know, it doesn't make it, it is what it is, you know. Somebody once said to me, like, if an animal falls into a drain, you don't stand around for 20 years wondering why it fell in, just pull it out. You know? So, yeah, it was an innate, peculiar mental twist in me that I watched other people very carefully as an observer, and maybe as the youngest child, you know, I watched carefully what irritated other people, and I always wanted everyone to be okay. I didn't like controversy. I didn't like fights or arguments, even though I might cause them. I didn't like them. So yeah, I felt okay when you felt okay. And when you didn't feel okay, I didn't feel okay. But I mean, it meant somebody else was always pulling the puppet strings. Somebody else was always, you know, more important than me. And I deep down felt I really didn't matter. But nobody would have ever seen that. I kept a really good show on the road. I was the ultimate actress for a long, long time.
Looking back now, I mean, do you think that's a strong empathy quality, or is that a seeking quality, or what do you think? What's your summary?
I think it's empathy, but you know, your greatest strength is your greatest weakness, I've heard said. So there is a point in time where it becomes damaging, you know, and it can become an obsession just like anything else. And it tied in with all the other issues. It tied in with, you know, my constant dieting and, you know, not liking how I looked. And that was all for external validation. It was all for, do you think I'm okay? And that's not just, you know, unique to me or to, that's a cultural thing that our society promotes. So, and I mean, it's not just women, it's been promoted for men now, you know, there's just one body type and one shape, and, you know, it changes all the time, like in the 20s, whatever it was, and then come through to the 90s, and, you know, just, it really is endemic in our society that you're kind of expected to conform. And there was always a part of me, hugely empathetic, but also rebellious. And didn't like to walk, you know, that straight line. I was always testing boundaries. And again, it's that paradox of I want to be the people pleaser, but I also want to do all this other stuff and get away with it. And that was the big thing, like just get away with it, not get into trouble and have people still think I was this kind of goody two shoes that never put a foot wrong. And really what drove me, I suppose, to, you know, a breaking point was the energy that it took to keep that show on the road was just exhausting. You know, it was like having a foot on either side of the Grand Canyon. So on the outside, I wanted people to see this well put together woman, you know, with my husband and my children, and we were well turned out and there was nothing to see here. And then, you know, behind closed doors, I was obsessively dieting. I was drinking too much. I wasn't easy to live with. And there wasn't much peace or serenity between my two ears. And there wasn't much peace or serenity for people who were living with me. And that's what really drove me to dig deeper. You know, I cannot continue to do this. This is, you know, I had a moment of clarity. I had a moment of this just can't continue, you know, because something's going to give. And I really did believe that it could be either my mental health or my life at that stage. And it was time to get off and just find some other way. There had to be another way.
I mean, that makes so much sense. And we hear that a lot, you know, people talking about the gap between who they are and then the gap between who they truly are. And as you say, to maintain that, like the Grand Canyon, it's so energetically draining, I suppose, is to hold that presence for that other person, you know, that sort of social out being. But take me right back. I mean, are you conscious of when sort of the split occurred in terms of, you know, the true you, and then when suddenly it kind of going, I need to, there's me that loves to, you know, go around in nature and be out there and be outside, and then suddenly, poof, I've got to have a separate face too.
I've always had a sense I was really young, maybe about 3, but never really I don't really know what caused it, you know, maybe, it's, and trauma doesn't have to be big and dramatic, you know, it can be very small, but it's just something that flicks that switch. Yeah, and just maybe a change in dynamics of family situation, or I went to school when I wasn't quite four when I started school. I was 3 3/4. They were going to lose a teacher in the local school or something. And I was packed off at 3 3/4. Well, I wasn't packed off. I ran. I couldn't wait to get to school. I loved school up until kind of second class. And like, there was trauma in school. There was, you know, I was in the Ireland that my kids don't know anything about today, when people were slapped and treated really quite badly. And academically, I was always quite bright, you know, which doesn't mean anything, except I suited school. I suited, because I'm one of the 80% who learns in the way that school is given to you. So I was on the receiving end of some of the, and it was violence, you know, it was violence, and it was acceptable, and it was hugely traumatic, really. But as bad as it was for me as an empath, being on the receiving end of it, what truly, truly hurt and really was upsetting was watching other people. And the effect that that had on me, and this is a pattern in my life, would be if I saw somebody else getting into trouble for doing something, I would think one of two things: either I'm not going to do it, or I'm going to do it and not get caught. So in school, it became really important that I just toed the line. But then I love to talk. I love to distract people. And the teachers would always say, it's OK for you because you can still hear, but the kid you're talking to can't do two things at once. So again, I was always pushing the boundaries. I was trying to see, can I be this really good, well-behaved kid and still be the class clown? Still get away with, you know, what I want to get away with and not get caught. So that's a theme, you know, that's been there throughout my life. And it's something I have to watch, you know, on a daily basis. I can get sucked back into that dynamic of, am I being real? Am I being true to myself? Or am I veering off my own path because of somebody else's discomfort if I behave in this particular way? So when we change, people don't always like it, you know, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. If it's right for me, it's right for everybody else. That's one of my mottos.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you talk there, and it comes across almost that sort of disassociation. You know, part of you wants to be, you know, sort of be compliant and good and sort of going with it. And then there's a bit of violence in between. And then there's the other part of you that wants to push boundaries. And you can see why there would be two parts form quite early. You know, it's that, you know, I'll do it if I can get away with it. And that's kind of where I really want to be. But then I do this and I get out of trouble and I stay good and the empath in me. So that's a lot of emotions for a young person, really, I suppose, isn't it? You know,
yeah. And I mean, I didn't even know that wasn't normal. that's
sure.
Whatever you grow up with, you know, and whatever you experience, whatever I've experienced in my childhood and my young adult life, just was my normal. You know, I didn't know any different. I didn't know that there was another way. I didn't know that maybe my way wasn't the healthiest way. I didn't know any of those things. It was survival, you know, it was just get by, you know, do the best you can to stay under the radar, you know, as best you can. And then also seeking that, reward. Oh, aren't you great? Aren't you wonderful? You know, lots of just that dichotomy, you know, and today, I suppose I try to live in the middle ground, and that there is a third way between the black and the white, you know, but sometimes I don't see it because of my conditioning, you know, or how I grew up, that I won't see the third way. And sometimes I have to get a bit of perspective or have somebody throw their eye on, you know, I'm thinking, this, is this normal? What's normal? But, you know, is this dysfunctional or is this a healthy way for me to be reacting?
Well, it's very, I respect your self-reflection on that, because so many people don't. You just think, well, I am who I am. I'm enough. You know, it's like, well, are you?
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard to see through the layers or even to question your own layers. You know, it's them. But tell us, who was Lorna going to be and what was she going to do when she grew up? What was the plan?
So growing up, I was, as I said, I was always quite, you know, interested in school, and I worked hard at school. You know, I would have studied hard, and I was always going to do something in a caring profession. That was pretty obvious from, you know, maybe 14 or 15. I did work for somebody once who said that I should aim to be a doctor. And I kind of thought, I don't really think I have that in me, but I'm maybe a nurse. And then that led me down the road of thinking maybe speech therapist or physiotherapist. Or so at 17, I filled in my CAO form. So I was really young because I went to school before I turned 4. And I mean, everybody knew I wasn't 4 starting school, but nobody thought until I got to 6th class that I would be very, very young going into secondary school. So I repeated 6th class, and that was really difficult. You know, I went to quite a small country school, and there were only a handful of us in each class, but the few girls and lads that I did know went on ahead of me, and it made secondary school quite difficult. It made the transition into secondary school difficult. I came from, you know, as I said, quite a small school into an all-girls convent where most of the people who started in my year had all gone to primary school together. So it was tough. Primary school or secondary school, first couple of years in secondary school were tough. So, I filled in my CAO form at 17. So I was still really young. I was only 17 doing my Leaving Cert. It wasn't a transition year or anything at that stage. And I can't remember what my choices were, but I didn't really get the whole, you could only go, I think you could, like, say you got your third offer, you could only get your second or your first, you couldn't go down. And I probably didn't fill it in right. But I ended up getting social work in Trinity. And I went to Trinity for 4 years and got my degree. I was too young to finish my degree. You had to be 21 going into your final year. So I took a year out and went and lived in Australia for a year. And qualified at 21 as a social worker. And is that what I always wanted to be? I've no idea. I used to joke when people said, why did you end up being a social worker? And I said, well, I thought I might as well get paid for what I've been doing for the last however number of years in my life. In other words, trying to fix people and make people happy. Very deluded in what I thought social work was. You know, but that was my youth and my kind of very, what would I call it, rose-tinted glasses view of, you know, what that career would mean. It was a very idealized, simplistic view, I think, at the time. But how do you know at 17 what you want to do for the rest of your life? So I did that until I was 27 or 28. And then I had my eldest daughter, and I never went back to that career. I didn't go back to social work.
Was that on purpose?
Or yeah. it was tough. It was a tough career. It was a difficult system to work in, and it wasn't proactive enough for me. There was too much fire brigade kind of chasing the problem. You know, preventative work wasn't really, it's not fun. It wasn't funded very well. I don't believe it still is, because you can't measure prevention. So, and I always wanted to stay at home when I'd have children. So I had three children in 3 years. So I was busy and stayed at home with them as a full-time mother.
What do you call them? Irish twins or Irish triplets, that is, maybe?
No, not quite. Well, 3 years and 4 months. So yeah, they're 19, 18 and 16 now.
She just missed the title, you know.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, I think that's fabulous that, you know, for that to come along and you know, interesting. I mean, you said, you know, you always wanted to stay at home with the kids. Where did that come from?
My mom was a stay-at-home mother. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I suppose quite traditional and for someone who likes to book the trend, I was quite traditional in that kind of thinking. But I found the reality of being a stay-at-home mother also very different to what I had thought it would be. And it was a difficult time in my life, particularly after my second son, my third child was born. I possibly had postnatal depression. And I began to drink a little bit more. And it came back to that, again, that kind of soul sickness inside me where happiness was always around the corner. And again, I don't believe I'm unique in how this, you know, played out in my life. You know, so many people, myself included, for so many years, I was always waiting for Friday, waiting for payday, waiting for the next holiday, waiting for the house to be done up, waiting for, you know, the new car, whatever. And when it would come, it would be like, that didn't really hit the spot I thought it would hit. And there was always a part of me that probably daydreamed, you know, subconsciously, when I get married and have children, everything is just going to be perfect. Like, life is going to be really good. And life was and is really good, but it didn't fill that hole in my soul. And that's that kind of codependent, you know, undertaking something or going a particular path in your life and thinking that that's the solution. You know, but it's all external stuff. It's all outside. You know, it's not looking within. It's not fixing really the fundamental issue. So when I have five children now, but when that my son who's 16, when he was two, I stopped drinking. And that's when life started to really get better for all of us.
Just as you're speaking there, I suppose I'm conscious that here's, you know, you've come off the back of social work that you didn't quite really, so as you say, you don't quite know how it happened. You went through it. Again, you were sort of too young for qualifying. So you kept apart from those that are going through the system. You're doing this and then you're straight into the kids, which kids is, listen, that's a high energy sport. I don't care. So, you know, you are physically sort of growing in other human beings. It's very draining. And then the emotional requirements and then the physical requirements and everything else. And I'm kind of picking up that, you know, at this point in your life, you've given to everyone else. You're apart from where you could or should have been. And, you know, you kids as well. There's so much going on. And I don't, you know, I'd say this in the nicest way. It's like, I'm not surprised that maybe, you know, a drink or sort of trying to self-preserve because you've given out of your cup so much to other people, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, it was just, you know, it was at that time when the cup of tea became the glass of wine for a lot of Irish housewives, you know, and it wasn't unusual to have a glass of wine at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, or it wasn't unusual to push the shopping trolley around Aldi and put six bottles of wine into it for the weekend, you know. And as I say, I don't think I'm unique in that. And I don't think that that's stopped. I think people are still doing it. And fair play, if you can do it and it floats your boat and you don't pay any price for it, then I don't question it for anybody else. But for me, there was something inside me that knew it was wrong and knew that it wasn't helping my life and it wasn't making things better. But I just didn't know there was another way. And, you know, I just had this feeling inside me that I needed to get out of my head because my head was the problem. Like, my thinking was my problem, really. So it worked, and it worked for a while, and it worked quite well, and it shut the thinking off. And, you know, and I was very much functioning, you know. I didn't lose a job. I didn't crash a car. I didn't have my kids taken off me. There was no big dramas. But there was another part of me inside that knew, you know, this isn't okay. And thank God that little voice was there inside me that nudged me, you know, and that I had some kind of awareness or something very deep in my subconscious that said, you know, this isn't okay. This is not okay. And again, continuing to wake in the morning. And I hid it, you know, and I hid it really well. And I didn't hide my drinking. I didn't hide bottles in cupboards or anything like that. I was quite brazen about it. I made sure nobody ever really questioned it, you know, because I couldn't be the problem. It certainly wasn't me, and it wasn't my drinking was, you know, my drinking wasn't an issue. And it, but it became harder and harder to, you know, put on the mask in the mornings and pretend I wasn't feeling seedy. And, you know, I just read an article recently, you know, and the word alcoholic really scares people. Like, it really freaks people out, you know, whether you think you are, or you think you're not. It's a word that people, there's a lot of stigma. And this article said, that's the wrong question. You know, what we need to ask ourselves is, am I free? And I wasn't free. I was a slave, you know, and when I talk about drink or dieting or shopping or relationships or anything outside of me that I'm trying to control, it's controlling me. So I wasn't free. And thank God, a part of me was screaming to get freedom, you know, because that gave me the motivation to say, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try to just not drink, you know, for today and see how it goes. And initially it wasn't easy. You know, I had days where there was high stress, and that had been the solution, you know, and not for a very long time. Like, it wasn't a problem for a very long time, but typically women, you know, our physiological makeup means that we won't tolerate drinking excessively for as long as a man's body can take it. So it didn't take very long for me to feel really awful a lot of the time. And I wasn't drinking every day, you know, I wasn't a daily drinker. But if I was drinking, then the next day I was trying to recover from it. So it was affecting. If I drank one day, it would affect 2 or 3 days. So it had to go. And thank God it did.
It's interesting. A while back, you referred to it as your condition. Is that your take on it now?
To be honest, it's just something I don't do anymore now, you know. But I remain conscious of why I needed it. So when I talk about my condition, it's that kind of spiritual unwellness that could resurface again, you know, and that niggle in my head that it'd say, you're not feeling great, you know, what used to work. Now, I haven't thought of having a drink in years, you know, because my life is too good today to put any kind of, you know, toxin into my body. Such as alcohol, that I know doesn't suit me. And I like myself too much today to do that to myself. And I like how I live. And I live kind of a pretty simple life. It's not, you know, I lived in Dublin for quite a few years, and I loved what I call the high life. You know, I loved eating out and shopping for expensive clothes, and, you know, but it was all surface. It was all what it looked like, you know. And today, it's like my whole life's been turned on its head. And the things that give me such beautiful, satisfying pleasure today are so, so simple, like put me beside a river or a lake or swimming in the sea, you know, looking at my chickens, growing some vegetables. And I still love to travel, and I like meals out, but I don't need these things, you know. I think that's the difference, is I needed something to take the edge off my head and my thinking for so long. And I have quite a peaceful head today.
Do you like yourself now? Do you love yourself?
Yeah. And I didn't, you know, I grew up believing I was ugly and that my body shape wasn't right. And I really grew up with a strong sense of self-loathing. And it's really sad, you know, and it's really sad to see that continue today. And a lot of young women wanting to change what they look like. And that's not to say if, you know, somebody makes a decision to alter their appearance and it's motivated from a real deep place of self-love, then, you know, carry on. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, again, this sense of, unless I look a particular way, I'm not acceptable, you know. my, you know, a real defining moment for me was at about the age of 11, maybe 11 or 12, just at that really awkward pre-adolescent stage, you know, where your body is changing and everything is, you know, there's so much going on. And a family member called me Big Nose, and I got really angry, and I was like, I don't have a big nose, and they were like, go and have a look at it, you know. And I can remember getting a mirror and checking it all out and thinking, oh, I do. And what I followed through with was, that makes me unacceptable, you know. But if you look at society, you know, at advertising, at book magazines, covers, films, how many overweight, big nose women are used in advertising campaigns? You know, they're not, because the narrative is, because you've got to be uncomfortable and dissatisfied for someone to be able to sell you a product. And you're just going to make somebody very wealthy on the back of that. And I came very close when I lived in Australia for that year. I contemplated for quite a while having plastic surgery on my nose, you know, and I thought, I'll come back and it'll be subtle and people won't notice. And it's so sad to think that for so many years in my life, I mean, I would make jokes about it so that other people couldn't get in ahead of me. So if I was in a group of people in a pub, you know, I might get up and say, I'm just going to powder my nose. I'll be an hour. And so sad to put yourself down in that way. But again, that was that little peculiar mental twist that was in me, that could be said to another kid at 11 or 12. And they just, you know, go to hell. No, I don't. I'm beautiful. I didn't have that. I just didn't have that inside me. But today I do.
No, I mean, listen, again, isn't it scary what can happen at a very, you know, and as you say, it doesn't need to be big, it doesn't need to be tragic, crazy, massive, whatever. It can be the smallest of things.
Throwaway remark that can just trigger a sensitivity, you know, that maybe in a year's time or a year before it wouldn't have made any difference, but it was just, you know, that kind of perfect storm of an age. And, you know, and there were other, you know, things maybe that were said to me. And it was, you know, teenage, I think from 13, 14 to probably 17 were difficult years, you know, and they are difficult years to navigate. And they're even harder now. I mean, I didn't have social media and a phone in my hand constantly. We didn't even have a house phone. We had a telephone box up the road that people used to ring if they wanted to talk to us, and someone would come down and knock on the door and say, so-and-so's rang and they're, you know, waiting for you in the telephone box. So nowadays it's even more difficult, you know. And one of the victories for me, I have three daughters and they're 19, 12 and 6. And I feel really blessed to have them, you know, and I'm blessed to have my two sons, but particularly with my daughters, I get an opportunity to look at them at these, and you know, these key ages, and reflect back on, well, how was life for me at that time? And can I, you know, one of my passions is breaking cycles, and I may not break a cycle sufficiently enough for all of my kids to not have to go a similar road to me or learn their own life experiences, but I can loosen the chink, the, you know, the link a little bit, and just the fact that they know that you can question and there's another way to live, to me is, it means whatever I've had to go through and whatever pain I've had to go through is really worth it. And, you know, it's a victory for me that I sat a few years ago with my eldest daughter in a medical setting in an office. And one of the questions, she was asked her weight. And she looked at the medical practitioner and she looked at me and she said, I don't know. And I was like, yes, yes, my daughter doesn't know what she weighs. I knew what I weighed every single day, several times a day, you know, for 25 years. And that only ended about 6 years ago. So that to me is a victory.
That is beautiful in so many ways. I'm caught, you know, I suppose I was struck there when you were saying, you know, not to break the cycle, I think was the thing, you know, and you know, sort of, I think your wording was, you know, there to that, that was reward in itself, just to not to, to pass it on or to break the cycle. Does that, is there a pleaser element in that though, that you're sort of saying, well, okay, I'll suffer it, but as long as nobody else suffers, then that's okay.
Yeah, listen, it's a reality check now that I have, you know, three, almost four teenagers, that I can't save the world and I can't save my kids, and they are on their own journeys and they will have to learn their own life lessons, and I cannot protect them from pain. And, you know, and it still comes out in me, absolutely, where, you know, the hamster will be on the wheel in my head, kind of, what do they need? Oh, how can I steer them down this road so that they don't go that road, because I can see trouble down that road. It's not my business. You know, I gave birth to them and I thank them for choosing me to be their mother. But that's probably the biggest challenge, you know, in my recovery, is to let go, you know, just let go, let them learn their lessons, let them feel their own pain, be there, you know, you can be there if they need you. But instead of always wondering, you know, what do they need? Though the biggest challenge for me is kind of turning that around and saying, what do I need today? And then when I take care of my needs, I am there if they need me. So yeah, we're just stepping into a new, you know, our eldest daughter has just moved out. She's going to college. So there's all of that. And the two boys are kind of coming up to the end of their school, secondary school journey as well. And that can be a big blind spot for me. Big, big blind spot. You know, I can wade in both feet. I'm here to save the day. And they don't even want me. They didn't even ring me. They didn't even ask me to do it for them. They just want me to leave them alone. And you know what? Fundamentally, when I can do that, it's so much more empowering, and they know they're trusted, and it gives them that message. Like, I trust you to take care of yourself. But they've seen me model self-care. So that's another thing that I'm always saying to particularly mothers who come for treatments. I'm like, your kids are watching. They don't care what we say. They watch what we do. And, you know, if you're not taking care of yourself, you're modeling that for your sons and your daughters, that, you know, you've got to be this martyr and run yourself into the ground. And then you're kind of always slightly resentful. It's like this seething kind of, you know, but we chose to have them. You know, we chose to have them. We knew the responsibility we were taking on. And, you know, the better I take care of myself, the less likely that tiredness and exhaustion will end up with me kind of complaining to them about the fact that I'm doing what I am responsible for. But figuring out the basics of what you are actually responsible for as a parent can be really challenging. You know, so sometimes I joke with my kids at home, it's like there's different care packages. So they're on like the basic care package, and that's, I feed them, I give them a home, I educate them, and their clothes come from kind of just average shops. And then if you want to go into the silver or the gold or the platinum package, you got to bring something to the party, like, you know, go and get a part-time job. And if you want to buy those things, you got to contribute. And, you know, so they're good kids. They're nice kids. I like my children, which is nice. I like to spend time in their company, and I find them really interesting. You know, they teach me so much every single day.
I mean, that's so beautiful to say, you know, that your kids, you know, and there's trust there, you know, and to be able to, like I say, they don't necessarily need to, they've taken away the fundamentals, you know, that it's the subconscious, unconscious parenting. That's, you know, it's truth, it's worth, it's, you know, it's beauty, it's being listened to, it's spending time, as opposed to the, you know, it'd be very easy to ride in on the conscious horse and say, yep, you know, this would be a good career, and that'll, you know, that'll be the right thing. And as you say, you apply your knowledge and wisdom onto them, you know, and, yeah. And it's fair play to you for doing that.
Yeah, look, I don't do it all the time. I mean, if you interview them for 2 hours, they tell you a different story.
Well, that's their job too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I've made loads of mistakes. They know that. But I can admit when I'm wrong, and I can say that I'm sorry, you know, and that's it. a nice gift to be able to give to your kids, like just to be able to say, look, I don't know everything. And they put me in my place sometimes. And I like that. You know, I think that's okay that they're not just kind of standing back and saying, okay, we'll do whatever you want us to do. Like they push my boundaries. They test me. And the greatest challenge is to trust them and let them go. You know, that's scary as a parent. But, you know, and kind of in the last 6 months or so, I've been thinking, well, I survived, you know, and there wasn't anybody coming along all the time sweeping up after me and checking, you know. There was kind of a mindset about me that I could cope, you know. That was kind of probably the belief system about me and my family was, you know, Lauren is really solid and she can just get on with life. Because I was the swan, you know, I can't blame people for thinking that about me because that's all I showed. There were a few cracks, you know, that showed over the years, but I papered them over very quickly. And but a lot of the time I was frantic underneath it all. Not always consciously aware that I was frantic. But with my kids, I am what I am, and they know my story, and I've never dressed it up or, you know, because they were young. Like, so I have two children who are 12 and 6 who've, you know, one of them actually thought that no mammies drank beer. She said that to me a couple of years ago. She said, I don't think any mammies drink beer. I said, no, lots of mammies do, just your mammy doesn't. But the older children were 6, 4, and 2, you know, when I stopped drinking. So sometimes it can be, and again, it can be a bit of a self-defeating, not a very healthy attitude, but, you know, we can assume as parents that when they have problems, it's all our fault, you know, that's because, and that would be my default setting, you know. Again, it comes back to the fixer, you know, and you can call that controlling as well. I'll be honest about that. But that can come back to that kind of, it's my fault, everything's my fault, but I'm not that powerful. And just like there were loads of people who influenced my life and whose actions or words affected me equally, my kids are affected by lots of people other than me. So that's when I talk about catching myself, you know, and kind of, I'll be in it sometimes, like up to my neck, I'll have waded right in with that whole narrative of, oh my God, this is my fault. Like they're in emotional pain because of X, Y, or Z that happened when they were, I can't change that, you know, and kids forgive and they love so unconditionally. And sometimes it's that unconditional love and forgiveness that I need for myself to just say, look, you were human doing the best you could with what you had at that time. You know, once you woke up, you saw your ways, you changed them and you continue to change them on a daily basis. And there's no perfection. You just try and make progress and do the best you can. And, you know, I'm always saying that to mothers who come in here. We're so hard on ourselves. Like you would never speak to anybody else the way you talk to yourself in your own head. And what would you say if your best friend rang you up and said, oh, I've just said this to one of my kids, you know, say that to yourself. But we don't. It's like, you know, this inner critic that runs this narrative in the back of your head. And I turn her down a lot of the days. You know, sometimes I get the remote control and switch her off. And then she can have days where she comes out and she's loud and screaming. But she can't run the show because it's not a healthy way to live.
It's interesting. You still talk about her in the third person.
Mm.
What do you mean?
Yeah, I've never really thought about that, but I suppose I have done work to incorporate, you know, to incorporate that inner critic and to thank her, you know, to say thanks. And I often will do that. I will personify an issue because it's a kind of a tool I find helpful to give me perspective on it. So in the early days when I was, you know, not taking a drink and finding it difficult, I kind of personified that dependency on alcohol. And I would be like, kind of tell myself the battle was on for my soul, you know, and this thing was up early in the morning getting ready to snare me on any given day. So yeah, I do that, and I talk about my inner children and they're all, but I suppose it's not in that dissociative way that it might once have been. You know, it's they're there, they're part of this bigger makeup of, you know, that is my essence. They are all these parts of, it's not just the black and the white or the good and the bad. It's like shades of gray right across the spectrum. And, you know, all those parts are me, you know, they are all there. And if I try to push them away or repress them, they just try to shout a little louder. So why not give them their, you know, 5 minutes or whatever they need, and then just say, listen, thanks very much. I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to keep me safe. You don't want me to take a risk here. But I've got this. So you can just sit back down in your corner again for a little while.
I love it. And you talk about, you call it an inner critic. And is that the best way? Or do you have sort of different personalities or different voices?
Oh, her name's Maud. Her name is Maud. And she is just this. I met her at a weekend that I did with a really good friend, a group of friends of mine. I met my inner critic. Like, we were encouraged to personify her and write about her. And her name's Maud. And she sits in a corner and she never goes anywhere. And she doesn't do anything and she takes no risks. And she would just love me to sit down and be quiet and not tell anybody the truth, you know. So it's kind of that don't feel, don't trust, don't talk would be her motto. And yeah, she had a place and she looked after me for quite some time. But, it, you know, if I was to allow her to run the show, I wouldn't be talking to you today. I wouldn't be running my business. I wouldn't take any risks. I would just be safe. And I mean, safe as in play it safe, you know. And life wouldn't be nearly as interesting, or as, you know, as it is today.
Can you be you if there's different parts of you in different places?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's not that these different entities, it's not a, it's certainly not a multiple personality issue or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's part of having become aware. You see, I developed those parts of me, that fracturing to survive. So they are, you know, they are still my teachers, you know. So my inner children, they're part of my makeup. They're part of, and I'm not aware of these, you know, the inner critic, my inner children, on probably 98% of my days. But when I'm losing that kind of, and I can have serenity in the midst of, you know, what appear to be on the surface really overwhelming situations. Like, for the most part through the lockdown, I was pretty serene because I was grounded and connected. And I truly believe that I'm being taken care of, you know, by a power that's outside of me. And that, so when I lose that sense of peace, or when that serenity feels, you know, when the hamster is back in the wheel, the chances are I'm not living from that deep centered place. That's some issue. I'm revisiting some pattern, some issue that I've had over and over again, you know. And my experience is I continue to meet the same kind of people with different names and the same situations repeatedly until I wake up and realize my part in something and change. So, you know, I could have an experience where I'm back into the codependency, I'm trying to fix somebody, and that will often be, you know, not necessarily an inner child, but an inner child reaction. So that's an opportunity for me to either go back and revisit it and say, who first made me feel like this? Why do I believe what I believe? Who taught me that? Is it serving me today to believe that? Is there something else I can believe? And then change the belief. So they're there. They're simmering away. They're not nearly as, you know, like, there was a time in my life when that's all I was. But I said at the beginning, I was just this made up part of, all these different kind of caricatures of who you needed me to be, they're now incorporated. They're now, you know, and some of them probably have been left completely, you know, but there would be still elements of that thinking there and that very deep reaction in your central nervous system, which can be really difficult to control through any form of thinking. So that's when I feel them, is, you know, when I'm feeling really triggered or there's an old trauma that feels like it's coming up again, the natural state will be, what did we used to do to fix this? Okay, we'll run with that because there's nothing else in the toolbox. And then I get to put a kind of a set of principles into place. You know, can I really do anything about this? Like, have I power in this situation or do I not? You know, if I don't, then accept and let go. You know, I say let go or be dragged. If I can't let go, I will absolutely do so much harm to myself because my obsessive thinking will start and I will be trying to shoehorn or force, you know, some sense of control, which is a total illusion, onto a situation. So that's a really long-winded way of answering that question, Pete, but that's what it means to me, you know, to have those different elements of myself. And that's what, when I talk about authenticity and kind of being grounded and being spiritually connected, it means no element of me is running the show. It's like a very centered, grounded and balanced me that you will meet. And it's me, you know, it's when I'm connected to a deeper consciousness and I'm aligned with my values. You know, I'm living from a sense of what I believe my and what I know to be true for me. And my core values, as opposed to, well, what do you think, Pete? Oh, and I'll just go with that. Yeah, that's great. And then if I talk to the next person, they said something completely different to you. Oh, no, that's fine too. So, yeah, I hope that answers the question.
It doesn't. You know, I think so many people, that'll resonate with so many people, that we have these different voices, you know, these, you know, what do you, as you say, what do you think? What do you, you know, what do you, you know, who cares what anyone else thinks, right? You know, it's like,
yeah.
I'm me and the only person that really matters is me. And, you know, and I love that question you asked, you know, and saying, are you free?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is so powerful. You know, are you, you know, am I being me and are you free? I think, you know, it's that in itself is so, so powerful.
Yeah, so there's nothing, there's no better feeling. Nothing I've ever done when I was self-harming, and that's what it was, you know. What I was always seeking was that escape or connection. What I was actually looking for was connection, you know, but in all the wrong places. And truly being free, and I don't have it every day, but when I get those glimpses, that really strong sense of wow, like I can remember taking a surfing lesson in Achill, you know, and it was, you know, I remember my first holiday that I brought my kids on after I'd stopped drinking, and we rented this little cottage in Achill, and every night I used to dress them up in their wellies and their raincoats and their little woolly hats, and we'd go down to the rock pools and, you know, be looking for little things. And I went for a surfing lesson, you know, and I rang a friend of mine. And I was like, I've just been surfing, you know, and it was like, this is stuff that I feel alive. I feel I am, like I'm able to be, like to properly be in myself, not caring what you think about me, and not, you know, having any ill feeling towards you because you might think that I'm not great. I'm not going to be everybody's cup of tea. That's fine, you know. But living that, you know, when people would say, what other people think about you is none of your business. You know, I could say that, but to really live it, you know, to really, really live that is a challenge. And it's like, that's freedom. You know, that is freedom, because you only get, like, that is such a cliche, but this is not a dress rehearsal. You really only get one shot at this. And when I look back over my life for the last 13 years, say in 6 month periods, I would often just take maybe a bit of a retreat or a few days away every 6 months or so. And when I look back over that previous 6 months, like the trajectory is always going up. Like there's always a little bit of an improvement. It doesn't mean there's more zeros in the bank balance. It doesn't mean, you know, people don't get sick or die or any of those things. Life will still happen. But my ability to cope and to stay present and to stay true to myself has always increased and increased and increased through challenges and through life and through, you know, life just showing up in the way that it has this habit of doing. And for that, I'm so thankful. I'm thankful every single morning I wake up, that I wake up, you know, I wake up without a hangover. I wake up in a relatively happy home, that I'm not the cause of misery for people. And I go to bed at night and I always just say thank you, you know, and I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. And I just say thank you, you know, to be able to put my head on the pillow. And I never want to forget just how miserable my life was at the end of all of that. You know, it wasn't a nice way to live. And I don't want to sacrifice that today. I don't want to give it up. I don't want to change it. I just want to move forward. And, you know, if I can, if me speaking about this today makes one person think differently about maybe a pattern that's developed in their lives, then it's worth being a little bit vulnerable, you know, and you got to be vulnerable. Vulnerability is part of having courage. You know, Brené Brown talks about that so wonderfully, that unless we can be vulnerable, and not everybody's going to like it, you know, not everybody's going to be happy or like it, or that's not the motivation today.
It's funny you mentioned Brené Brown, because you know, you remind me of her. You know, there's something there's a calmness, there's a humbleness or something there, you know. But sorry, just that was just what was on my mind.
It's a nice compliment. Thank you.
Yeah, isn't it? And exactly. It's but take us through, if you would, and I don't sort of want to drag you back into, but can you take us through that moment of change, you know, because I personally believe, and I love the expression, you know, from great overwhelm comes great change. And, you know, the moment when it did, it pivoted for you.
Yeah, it was in 2007. And it was I was very close to my maternal grandfather growing up. And I didn't realize it at the time. But it was actually on the date of his anniversary of his death. So the 23rd of July, 2007. It was the most undramatic, uneventful, and really perfect way that it happened, you know. I'd had a drink the night before, nothing excessive, and something had happened, and I'd wanted to go and rescue somebody the next morning. Somebody who I was concerned about their drinking, which is just hilarious, you know, when I think about it now. So I offered to help them, you know, and I was like, I'll get you help. I'll help you. And I was humble enough to kind of say, I know what it feels like, because I think I might have this problem too, but it wasn't about me at that moment. So to get rid of me, they agreed that I could help them. And later on that afternoon, you know, they just sent me a text and said, listen, thanks very much, but I'm not taking you up on that offer. And I had planned to bring them somewhere, to a kind of a support group. And I read the text and my husband was in the kitchen, and I said, oh, that's so-and-so. She doesn't want to go and get that help. And I never planned to say the next words. I said, but I'm going to. And I can still remember the look on his face, because I had him convinced there was no problem. You know, probably he was the problem, but I wasn't. And that was the beginning of it. Was, you know what? It was the first time in my life, as somebody who'd spent a lifetime up to that point, I was 34. I was 34. So I'd spent my life being the fixer. And it was the first time in my life that I had to say, do you know what? I can't do this by myself. I need help. And I got humble and I asked for help, And people made suggestions and I tried what they suggested because I knew that I couldn't do this by myself. And it's one of the greatest things and one of the most difficult things for human beings to say is, I need help, you know, and especially somebody who was conditioned to be the one that everybody else turned to, you know, the one who went into a career to fix other people. Her own life was falling asunder. And it was the, like, I've never, ever, ever looked back. I've never regretted that decision. I've never regretted. There were years where I regretted some of the stuff that had happened, you know, during the time that I was drinking. But today I don't have, you know, for a long time I would have felt quite a lot of shame and regret and wished it had never happened. And obviously I never wanted to hurt anybody else, you know, through my drinking. But today I don't regret any of it, you know, because I had to do what I had to do to get the willingness to change. There had to be enough pain to motivate me into thinking, I just can't do this anymore. And my arrival into trying to recover was perfect, because had it been dramatic, had somebody been holding it over my head, or had my husband been on my back all the time, like, I know the kind of person I am. If you tell me to go left, I go right, you know. So I slithered into recovery. I always say that, like, it was just perfect. I just slithered into, I probably had one glass of wine the night before, and the next day, that was it. I'm now somebody who's going to try to live life without alcohol, you know. And then years later, I'm now somebody who's going to try and live without dieting. I'm someone who's going to try and live without, you know, restricting my food. I gave up, thank God I never, you know, took prescription medication, but I would have to be somebody who says when I go to a doctor, listen, I'm not somebody who can go that road, you know, is there some other way? And that's probably also why, you know, what I do, the reflexology and massage, you know, is it's not instead of, you know, traditional medicine, it's complementary. It's, you know, to try and support people who are in need of support for their mental health or for other issues. So yeah, I slithered into recovery.
I'm really grateful for you for sharing that. And I suppose it's the admitting the vulnerability and, you know, all the stuff, you know, and we've all done it, you know. It's like, well, you know, it's like, I'm not the problem here, but listen, if it helps somebody else, then I suppose I'll go and get help. Yeah, do you know what yeah. I mean? It's like, we can't even accept it as, you know, it's, well, the eye can't see itself, but it's like, well, okay, if I'm sort of going to be a martyr here, I'm going to put myself through the process and then maybe that'll, I can then help others more. And you're like,
yeah,
okay.
And listen, if that's how it happens for people, who cares? You know, some people do. Yeah. Do it for somebody else initially, and then eventually they do it for themselves, you know. And I learned that pretty early on, you know. I had it said to me, like, don't do this for your kids, because if they, you know, pee you off sufficiently one day, you might just think, oh, to hell with them, you know, I'm gonna have a drink because they're not doing it my way. Yeah, and I mean, I suppose the bigger issue, which I didn't realize at the time when I stopped drinking, was that I didn't realize that 25 years of dieting had also been just an obsession that had lived with me, you know, alongside my drinking. And it probably did get worse, you know, when the cork went in the bottle. I probably then focused on that quite a bit more. So yeah, that's about... I was 42 when I did my last diet, and that's been a whole journey in itself. That's just been so revelatory and exciting too in its own way.
25 years, what do you mark as the start point?
17. I was 17, went to college, made my debs at 17. I know what I weighed, and I'm not going to say what I weighed because it's not important, but it was substantially less than what I weigh today. I don't know what I weigh today, actually, but I know from photographs I was, you know, perfectly formed and beautiful. And when I moved out, you know, as is often the case, it was fantastic. There was takeaways and all sorts of, and I probably didn't want to cook a whole lot. So I did gain weight, and it was just unacceptable to me, you know. It was like, no, this can't happen. So I did my first slimming club at, you know, at 17, 18, lost the weight very successfully because I'm really driven, and if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it 100%. And yeah, so I've weight cycled from 17 to 42, probably up and down the scales, maybe, I don't know, a couple of stone, and dress sizes from, you know, 10 to size 20 in my cupboard, and hit a rock bottom with that. Yeah, coming up on 6 years ago. So after I'd had my last daughter, she's six now, and I fed all my kids and everything, but I would have tried the recovery route with food, but I always found it really difficult. I found as soon as I would be advised to restrict any food group or any type of food, that's all I'd want to eat, you know. So, and demonized, you know, kind of sugar is the problem, or this is the problem, or this is the problem, when really what was underneath it all was, again, the same sense of, you know, am I worthy? Do I matter? Why do I need somebody else to approve of my weight, shape, or size? So I joined another slimming club, and I've done them all. I've done all these ridiculous diets, and would, you know, diet really successfully. But diets don't work for 95% of people. Like, that's, you know, been statistically proven. So it's just like, I could stop drinking, but I couldn't stay stopped. So I could lose weight, but I couldn't keep it off. And believed that the problem was me. You know, I must just try a different diet, or try harder. And yeah, so I joined the Slimming Club, and oh my God, I was their greatest advocate. I mean, my friends were just bored of listening to me. You know, I'd be like, oh, this is amazing, and it's not a diet, it's a lifestyle. And again, it's like, I don't have an issue with anyone who drinks. I don't have an issue with anybody who goes on a diet, if it's motivated from a place of self-love and self-care. But mine wasn't, you know. But I wasn't even aware of that. So joined this slimming club and got down to this target weight and did all sorts of crazy things, you know. And I know women can relate to this, because I know I'm not the only one who's done it. Like, I weighed my clothes in the kitchen scales before I would go to see, like, what are the lightest clothes that I can put on. You know, spend ages in the bathroom. I wouldn't drink water the morning of a weigh-in. And I would be paying these people, whatever it was, 10 euros, to tell me what I weighed. I'd weighed myself before I left the house, and I'd have put the scales in, like, on the carpet, on the tiles, you know, on one leg, whatever. They were just going to tell me something that I already knew. And so I got down to my target weight, and it was like the holy grail once again, you know, buy the clothes in the smaller sizes or whatever. And I stayed at that weight for like probably 3 days, you know, because I was either heavy, trying to be thin, terrified, then being thin, afraid of getting heavy. So it was like, you know, I was heading one way or the other all the time. And so if diets worked, these companies wouldn't make any money, because when you get to your target weight, you're a free member. So technically they should be out of business if it worked. So I had free membership for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then I slipped out of my target weight and I couldn't really get back into it. And then I got back into it, you know, and often by really unhealthy means, you know, like not eating well, just not healthy for me. And so I got back into my target weight, and they have this little chit chat, you know, after everybody's been weighed. And the lady who was running the class came to me, and she was like, oh, it's great, you're back in your target weight. And I burst into tears. And she said, oh, you're really happy. And I said, no, I've just realized I have to do this for the rest of my life. And something like the biggest light bulb just went off inside my head. And I came home. My husband came home from work that night. And we had a skip at the house. We were doing a bit of a clear out. And I said to him, I've put the scales in the skip. And he was like, oh, okay. And I said, well, and he went, well, what if I want to weigh myself? And I said, well, you won't be able to because I've beaten it with a sledgehammer. So I took the weighing scales into the garage and got a sledgehammer and beat it and threw it into the skip. And it was the most liberating thing that I have ever done in my life. So that's 6 years ago. And in those years, I have... I've recovered from disordered eating. I now know, like, I was never labelled with an eating disorder, but I've had disordered eating for most of my life. I was a fussy eater as a child. Food couldn't touch on the plate. I didn't like certain textures. It was always, always, always an oddity in how I ate. And I have done the most incredible things, because now I see my body as a vehicle for my life. And one of the most life-changing things, and I would encourage any woman or any man out there who's got body image issues, is a documentary called Embrace by a woman called Taryn Brumfitt. She's an Australian woman. And it blew my mind. I went to see it on International Women's Day, and I got, you know, I began to get involved in the body image movement, body positivity. I hosted a showing of that documentary for like 50 or 60 women down in Leitrim at a cinema. I told my story that night. I've done presentations. I'm a Guinness World Record holder for the most women skinny dipping. 2,500 women.
Wow, just a moment. Just say, wow, fantastic. 2,000, yeah. How many?
2,504 women got into the Irish Sea in Wicklow, stark naked for 5 minutes. We had to stay in for 5 minutes, and it's never been beaten since. And we raised over €500,000 and bought a house for the children of St. John's Ward in Crumlin for their families to stay in through Evine's Pink Tie charity. And you know something, that day, Pete, I looked around, myself and my friend did it. And her mum wasn't long dead from cancer. She was only dead 3 weeks. And we did it together. And we went down. You were only allowed to wear your bathrobe down onto the beach. No cameras, no nothing. And it was a beautiful day. The sun was splitting the stones. And we stood for about 15 minutes talking to each other. And I was like, people were getting tattoos and things drawn on their bottoms. And I said to her, will we go up? And she was like, oh, okay. And I said, we'll just take our bathrobes off. And she was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. So we just took them off. And for about 15 or 20 minutes, you were like, I don't know where to look. Where do I put my eyes when I'm talking to this other naked lady? You know, I spent hours on that beach. We eventually got into the sea and did the bit we were there for. But you just stood around talking to all these women. It was like all different shapes and sizes. No two bodies the same. There was breast cancer survivors. There were women with one breast, two breasts, no breasts, you know, scars. It was incredible. And I have never looked in the mirror since and thought, oh, I don't like this part or I don't like that part. I'm like, my body is amazing. It gets me up every morning. It does everything I needed to do. It just is incredible. And my heart breaks for women who still torture themselves every single day thinking, you know, if you all that BS that we were taught, if you can pinch more than an inch and all that kind of stuff that we're just brainwashed with. So, you know, aside from my recovery from, you know, abuse and alcohol, I have to say that the recovery from my body image issues probably has the most profound effect on me on a daily basis. Because it's been there for such a long time. And I'm so thankful. I'm so thankful that I didn't, you know, I've written a lot about this. And, you know, I wrote one day, someday somebody's going to carry my coffin on their shoulders. And they're not going to be thinking, oh, she weighs a half a stone more than she did last year. You know, they're going to be talking about, oh, she was great crack and the fun we had with her and the nights out and she's a gas ticket. And do you remember this experience and that experience? Because the people who love us don't see what we look like. They see through all of that. So yeah, that's, you know, I'm really thankful that I've had light bulb moments in my life. Really, really thankful that mean today I am free. That I don't wake up in the morning thinking, oh, why did I eat that yesterday? Oh, I'm not going to eat it today. This is it. Today is the day. And by 11 o'clock, head in a packet of biscuits. Ah, I'll start again tomorrow. You know? And it just gives me the freedom. Like, I say yes to life now all the time because I'm not conscious. I'm not, you know, I came down here this morning to do this interview with you. I don't wear makeup anymore. I don't dye my hair. And again, if you dye your hair and wear makeup and it makes you feel good, that's great. This is part of my journey in life to just say, this is me. Like, this is just me. It's just how I am. And it's, yeah, it's been an amazing 5 or 6 years. And I've, you know, I just don't ever, 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 ever want to give up this freedom that I have today.
Wow. Are you worthy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you trust yourself?
I trust my inner self. Yes, I trust my inner wisdom. I don't always trust what I think, but for the most part, what I think now is on the same track as my inner wisdom. It's a muscle. It's become more of aligned, you know, the two are more aligned now than they would have been, say, 10 years ago. I would have had to check in with myself quite a bit more or get perspective, you know, get someone to help me see the wood for the trees more 10 years ago than I do now. Now I'm kind of pretty aligned. Yeah, I do trust myself.
And what's a real pleasure for you? What do you love to do?
Oh, I love the sea. No question about it. I love the sea. I came from, you know, the East Coast, but I love the West Coast of Ireland, and the wilder the better. You know, I love places where it's like next stop America or heaven. So living in landlocked Roscommon doesn't really suit me that way. But I just hop in the car when I can. Obviously I can't at the moment, so if I can't do the sea, I'll do a lake or, you know, but I love the sea, love it.
I'm struck, you know, because when we were talking about, I asked you to describe your mini self, and you know, you talked about nature, you talked about you know, being sort of by the river or by the sea, and you know, that was, or in nature, mm-hmm. You know, that was the thing. And I'm struck at all this time later that actually, you know, the Guinness World Record and you know, that connection back to the sea, and even just saying, you know, what do you love to do? It's the sea. It's sort of, you know, and even the nakedness of going into the water, there's something very empowering about that.
Yeah.
You know,
I've met my crone a few times, I suppose, when I've traveled in meditative states, you know, and she's always beside the sea. You know, I've said to my kids, my husband, there's a joke in our house because he's a farmer, and he'd say, oh, we could buy some more land. And I'm like, well, unless you're buying it in the south of France or somewhere overlooking the sea, don't bother, you know, because that's, yeah, I'd love eventually to have, you know, a little cottage somewhere, just the wildness. And the sea to me, you know, I talk about this with a friend of mine quite often, like it just personifies for me everything we are. You know, it can be calm, wild, deep, shallow. It's never the same. And I love nothing more than, you know, a wild winter day walking on Ross's Point or Mullaghmore or somewhere. I have done a bit of sea swimming this year, and I know that's become a big thing, you know, around Ireland in the lockdown. People are heading for the sea every morning, and it's just really, you know, it's very grounding and very restorative. And I think it probably helps with our negative energy as well, just to ground us. So thank God for the mighty oceans.
What's your superpower?
Superpower. I can love unconditionally, myself and others. And I can say when I'm wrong, you know, and I can ask for help.
That's so powerful. And I'm struck by how open you've been here and how sharing, which is in my eyes is a superpower in itself, you know, to do that, because it's selfless. Very humbling too, you know.
I always say it's all I have, my story. For years, I, you know, if you ask me something, even if I didn't know the answer, I'd make it up. Full of ego. And it's all I have, you know, it's all I have to tell is my story. And that's, you know, I can't make that up.
Are you still carrying some of the past, you think? I mean, do we all carry the past with us, or?
Yeah. I have a friend who says, look back, but don't stare, you know? So yeah, it's what made me what I am today. So I don't want to, I don't regret it. I don't want to shut the door on it, but I don't have to live in it. And I can practice forgiveness when it does, you know, it can come back very okay. Not very often anymore, but sometimes there can be a little bit of a haunting from the past, and that's okay. It can be a teaching, you know, it can be a time to learn again. But the big thing is forgiveness, you know, have compassion for who you were at that time in your life. Doing the very best you could with what you had, you know. I'm saying that in the third person, but it's kind of, that's what I say to other people, you know, but that's what I say to myself, you know. Have compassion for yourself, Lorna. I'm a cheerleader for myself now. I ran a half marathon. I ran a few of them kind of when I turned 40, I think, the midlife crisis. But it was one of the things growing up, I always believed I couldn't run. My brother was a really good athlete. And I'd come home from school, sports days or community games, competitions, and I'd come in the door and I'd say to my mother, guess where I came last again? And she reckoned it was because I'd be waving at people. You know, I'd be running down the track, but I'd be trying to see who was there, you know. So I started to run. I was telling one of my kids last night, I started to run. And when I started, I couldn't run from my house. I couldn't run 300 meters, you know, and it was to challenge a belief about myself. You know, this is something that you can't do. Well, actually, I can do it now. I don't do it anymore because I didn't really enjoy it. But it was just to kind of, so yeah, those kind of things that just can come up. The old beliefs can still come back, but we get the chance. I get the chance, and anybody can have that chance. And I suppose that's, you know, if I was to have anybody hear anything from what I've said today and from sharing my story, it is that it is always possible to change and never give up hope. There's no such thing as a hopeless case, you know, to always keep that little, even if it's only the size of a mustard seed, keep that little seed of hope there.
What's on your bucket list? Tease us with something that's there.
Oh, goodness. I don't really have one, do you know? I actually really don't have one.
Is there a book in you?
Yes. That's on the list. If there's another lockdown, that's the project. There's a book. There's a book. I suppose because I have, you know, a big family and it's busy and, you know, I've still some parenting to do to get, you know, the six-year-old to, I'll be nearly 60 by the time she's 18. But all these things, there's time for everything. You know, I always had a fear of time. There was never going to be enough time. I was going to run out of time. So I don't have a bucket list because I live, every day is a great day. Like every day, there's something every day. You know, I try to practice gratitude and to be thankful. So I don't really have a bucket list, but yeah, there is a book and loads more adventures, lots more, who knows, maybe another Guinness World Record or something. I don't know, but I say yes to life, you know, today as best I can. So yeah, life will take me on a path if I can surrender and go with it. I know it'll be good.
Love it. I'm going to have to find a new name for the bucket list because people go, no, I don't have a bucket list, you know, because they associate it with death, but then they go, yeah. I'd love to do this, 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 and this, though. It's like,
for me, okay, yeah, well. I suppose I don't think of a bucket list because
Your love list. That's maybe a better one.
Yeah. I don't feel I'll need it, because if you just live every day well, who needs a bucket list?
No, very true. Very true. Well, let's change it to love list. I'd love to write a book.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to write a book. I need to write a book. There's a book in me that needs to come out.
Well, need to, want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just watching your language there, you know. But no. Oh, it's awesome. Tell me this in one or two words then. What's your fire in the belly?
I don't do one or two words very easily. You'll have noticed that. Compassion and acceptance and love.
Perfect. Had to sneak in a third one.
Oh, it's not the last word.
Oh, I love it. Where can people hear more, learn more, just get in touch with you? Just give us a shout out there.
So I'm very much a technophobe. So I'm at the early stage of building my business. So it's just a Facebook page at the moment. It's called Your Sacred Space with Lorna Dorley. And you can contact me through that to make an appointment. Or my mobile number is 086-790-9004. On my Facebook page, it's a bit of a mishmash of everything. It'll be about my treatments, body image stuff, just general, you know, musings and thoughts about life and a bit of guidance for people. But particularly at the moment with lockdown, you know, potentially coming again, I'm saying to people, you know, please do reach out. Like, don't ever be on your own. And if I can't help, I can probably find somebody who can help you, you know, but just to be there for people if they're in need.
Lorna, any final words?
Just live life, you know, every day as well as you can, being true to yourself. You won't go too far wrong.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for sharing. And no doubt we'll talk again soon.
Well, that was another great episode of Fire in the Belly. You know, this really wouldn't be possible without our great guests taking the time to share their personal journeys. And boy, sometimes it is personal. It's an absolute pleasure to have that, and then to hear the journeys that people have been on. We've loads more episodes coming up soon, and it's always a pleasure to have guests on. If you do happen to know anyone with true fire in their belly, please reach out to us so we can share their journey, lessons and successes. So, all that's left to say is have a great day, live with fire in your belly, and be the mightiest version of you.